Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
This episode of Canada Land is brought to you by Douglas, a mattress that is trusted by more than 200,000 Canadians from coast to coast to coast. It's a great mattress at a very reasonable price point. Comes with a 20-year warranty and a great deal for our listeners. Douglas is giving you a free sleep bundle with each mattress purchase. Get the sheets, pillows, mattress, and pillow protectors free with your Douglas purchase today. Visit douglas.ca/CanadaLand to claim this offer. That is douglas.ca/CanadaLand. This episode of Canada Land is brought to you by the Center for Addiction and Mental Health, CAMH. There is an incredible facility right here in downtown Toronto that is helping on the front lines and is doing incredible innovative research. They are a facility that treats everybody with dignity, and they need your help. May 6th to 12th is Mental Health Week. If this matters to you, help CAMH. There's no better place for your resources. Go to camh.ca/CanadaLand and donate now. Help CAMH treat addiction and build hope. Quick note before we start, I am still at work on our Thunder Bay series with Ryan McMahon, and we have a guest host today, and that guest host is one of the most interesting people I know, Sheila Hetty. She and her guests today, actually, both have books on New York Magazine's 100 Best Books of the 21st Century So Far list. And what else can I say about Sheila Hetty? She introduced me to my wife.
In 2001, Rachel Cusk published A Life's Work, the controversial memoir which detailed her experience of becoming a mother and dealing with a newborn. It was a work of literary criticism, a polemic, and was one of the most divisive feminist books of the last two decades. The reviews were alternately admiring and excoriating. If everyone were to read this book, one fairly mild review said, the propagation of the human race would virtually cease, which would be a shame. Cusk was subject to many personal attacks in Britain, often from female readers, saying that she was an unfit mother, was damaging her children, that she didn't deserve to be a mother, that there was something wrong with her psyche, simply because she had expressed the difficulties and ambivalences of new motherhood. But interestingly, despite these brutal personal attacks, Rachel's book inspired so many other female writers to write about their experiences of maternity in an honest way. I, for one, would not have written my book, Motherhood, without her courageous example. Over the years, I've had the pleasure of spending time with Rachel at residencies, on stage, over dinners. I've met her grown children, who, contrary to all predictions of damage to their psyches as a result of being written about, are two of the most impressive, funny, strong, and self-aware young women I've ever met. Rachel's 2012 nonfiction work, Aftermath, told the story of her divorce, and it was her last attempt to deal with her life in a memoiristic way. In interviews, she called the forum a dead end, since, like A Life's Work, it led readers and critics to contemplate and criticize her as a woman instead of her books as aesthetic objects. Her three most recent novels, Outline, Transit, and Kudos, form a loose trilogy and are widely recognized as representing a quantum leap forward for the contemporary novel. The New Yorker published a profile last year entitled Rachel Cusk Gut Renovates the Novel. Her work always seems to come out of a contemplation of exactly where she finds herself in life, turning the most commonplace experiences, like becoming a mother, divorce, the midlife crisis, into the material of art. I'm so excited to be speaking with Rachel, calling in from her home in the UK, about Canadian literary culture, middle age, receiving criticism, and how she moved away from the memoir form and reimagined the novel.
Jesse here again to tell you that this episode is brought to you by Brendan Wheaton, Dave Kiriluda, Elizabeth Gabriel, Lauren Wright, Brad Clark, Franziska Glenn, Jacqueline Spears, and Jesse Robertson.
My name is Jesse, and I'm a historical consultant based in Victoria. I support Canada Land because I believe that intelligent media criticism is one of our best defenses against the partisan attacks on media that have become so abundant.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp, therapy online that has served over 3 million people around the world, and it's available here in Canada. And this time of year, we're all emerging from our winter-like seclusion and, patio season and socializing, and it can be terrifically fun, but it can also create a lot of pressure. And some people get, social anxiety from being out too much. What did Iggy Pop say about social life? It's torture dressed as fun. It doesn't need to be torture. I think it's just about finding the right balance of how much of other people do you want. I mean, we need each other, but I think that at a certain point it can become overwhelming. And talking to somebody about yourself, about your social life, about your relationships is a way of gaining insight into what is right for you. It's not selfish to examine that with a professional. And as the largest online therapy provider in the world, BetterHelp can provide access to mental health professionals with a wide variety of expertise in mental health. Listeners of the show get 10% off of their first month at betterhelp.com/CanadaLand. That's better, H-E-L-P, betterhelp.com/CanadaLand. This episode is brought to you by Douglas, a mattress trusted by more than 200,000 Canadians from coast to coast to coast. Trust is important. There are a lot of mattress lies out there, a lot of mattress liars. And I didn't intend the pun, but it occurred to me that there is one as I was saying those words. Listen, I am not lying to you. I have experienced the Douglas mattress. It is an exceptional mattress at a surprisingly affordable price point. It is a mattress that sleeps cool, doesn't have that weird thing in the summer where the mattress gets like an oven. It's a very good product. It's delivered to your house in a box. You don't have to go to a big mattress store. It is a medium firm mattress, which is what Canadians prefer, and it comes with a 365-night trial and a 20-year warranty. What more can I tell you? Douglas is giving our listeners a free sleep bundle with each mattress purchase. Get the sheets, pillows, mattress, and pillow protectors free with your Douglas purchase today. Visit douglas.ca/CanadaLand to claim this offer.
Hi, Rachel.
Hi, Sheila.
So, Rachel, one of the things I wanted to talk to you about today, because our podcast kind of coincidentally is being published on the day of the Giller Prize shortlist, is you were shortlisted for twice last year and in 2014, and you traveled around the country, traveled around Canada with other Canadian writers and read their books. And I just want to start off by asking you if you came away with any impressions of Canadian readers, Canadian writers, if there is such a thing. You live in London, but you're Canadian, so there's sort of an outside perspective you have. Did you come away with anything?
Oh, a lot. There's a lot in there. I mean, I guess what I felt sort of conclusively was that despite having a Canadian passport, I would never be accepted as Canadian. And I think that comes from something that I was sort of curious about, which may actually be an aspect of Canadian identity that I'm sort of not familiar with, but that I've just noticed in this context, which is a not realizing how powerful you are. so there seemed to be what I've really encountered in writers and in readers was a feeling of Canadian literature as somehow endangered, or a sort of minority that needed to be sort of defended and protected. And for me, you know, one of the strange things, you know, Canadian identity is probably the most embryonic of my identities, because I mean, I was born there and spent early childhood there, but I don't really remember it. And I have this passport that has always seemed to me a passport that has something to do with writing and women's writing, because the women writers who shaped me partly were Canadian. And so I've always seen it as a place of incredible influence and power. I mean, it's literature. And yet what I found when I was there was almost the opposite. sensibility. So I didn't kind of work that out, really.
That's interesting. I mean, you published A Life's Work in 2001, and that was not only a female subject, but a female form. And I have a question for you about that, because you... Here, let me read this to you. This is something that you wrote in a narrative of your own literary trajectory. You said, "I began to work additionally in autobiography when the formal problems of the novel in representing female experience began to become more apparent to me." What does that mean, the formal problems of the novel in representing female experience? What are those formal problems? Why could the traditional novel not represent female experience? What did you see?
Because I felt that female experience needed to be directly owned. It needed to be an autobiographical eye that in its most constricting and oppressive moments, the moral, psychological and artistic problem of stepping outside the self, stepping outside I for the reader, it was a place where you lost the relationship to the truth of your own experiences. And I mean, just, you know, taking motherhood as an example, you know, how I wrote A Life's Work was by having a child and then by having another child. And it was only when I started having another child that I remembered what having a child had been like. So that, and it was only sort of a year later, but it astonished me that the memory and the language, the ability to describe those experiences melts away so quickly. And so I knew I had to write it down. And well, how was I going to do that as a novel? You know, that would have completely betrayed the basis on which I was remembering. And I didn't particularly want to write, you know, a book about me and about my baby, and indeed I didn't. I wrote a book about one baby through another baby. And I think novels are made very differently from that.
Right. Novels are made with more of a remove.
Well, I guess you build a novel, you have to build it like a building, so it stays standing when you're not in it. And the memoir is a much more, it's a different kind of contrivance, but it has to be in you. So you are the building, if you see what I mean. And so you use yourself as the building, and then other people can come and be in you for a bit. I mean, it's not to say that I haven't read compelling material in novels that crosses over into, you know, a lot of it weirdly written by men, like D.H. Lawrence, you know, describing sex or childbirth. But something about the mental state of the woman having the experience, to me, is captured in memoir, because the point about these experiences is that you feel that you are the only person who has ever experienced, you know, childbirth, or it's completely impossible to be universal in that moment, or even to feel that this is a shared cultural or gender experience. And it seems to me that the memoir is sort of the only, I mean, I wish there'd been another form, but it seemed to me that was the only one. But yeah, it entails a sacrifice of yourself.
Yeah, and then it comes with a complication if you are the building, as you put it, because then when you're interviewed, it's not about the form.
No, yeah.
It's not an aesthetic interview. It's about you as a person, and that comes with its own problems. I was listening when I was doing research for this interview to Mark Lawson talking to you on the BBC, and I was appalled at how much of the interview involved him asking you to account for your choice to write about being a mother in light of the effect it might have on your children. So you were asked to defend your books as a mother, as opposed to talk about them as an artist. And I wonder how much that repeated experience, which I assume it was repeated, led to you basically abandoning this memoir form in your last three books.
What I saw was that the form malfunctioned. It was too easy for it to be read literally. And very much the easiest thing to do is to use a person as a scapegoat, which is something that happens, you know, in ordinary life. And it also happened to my book. It was very easy for the very ambivalence that I describe in a life's work to prove itself by, I suppose, alerting certain readers to the presence of what I was saying in themselves, and to disown it, to repudiate it by saying, well, she feels that, there must be something wrong with her because I don't feel that. And that, as I say, that's the malfunctioning of the memoir form. So I couldn't seem to get rid of that, even in Aftermath. Aftermath was even worse. You know, I really struggled to create more sort of objectivity and universality to really, really limit the places where, you know, that literalism could sort of break through, and it couldn't be done.
Well, do you think that part of the sort of what compounds the literal reading is the fact of the author having to appear, like in an interview like this, for instance, that one draws attention to oneself as a writer in the public sphere, and that if you were able to withdraw, then you might be able to write in that fashion?
Yeah, I mean, I think that my withdrawal from these things will probably be complete when I have ceased to write anything, I imagine, those, or when I die. I think those two things will probably happen at about the same time. You know, I started out as a writer pretty young. I mean, I think I was, 26 or something when my first book was published, and it won a prize, and I lambed the slaughter. You know, I did everything everybody asked me to, and I was very, very, very exposed. And I've been trying and trying and trying to sort of free myself, you know, from those things. And it's a slow, I don't seem to be being terribly good at it.
Yeah, I mean, it's complicated because you are asked to do these things. And I kind of actually, I wouldn't mind asking you to read from this passage in Kudos, because this latest book of yours is so much about these things that the author is asked to do. It's the work of being an author apart from writing. You know, it's a whole professionalism, and it's so dreary. And would you read from that part that I pointed out?
Yeah, do you want me to start? She was a tiny, sinewy woman, or further down.
So okay. This is from your, this is from the book Kudos, which you just published this past year, 2018.
She was a tiny, sinewy woman with a childlike body and a large, bony, sagacious face in which the big, heavy-lidded eyes had an almost reptilian patience, occasionally slowly blinking. She had attended my event this afternoon, she added, and had been struck, as she often was, by the inferiority of these occasions to the work that was their subject, which seemed to be circled with increasing aimlessness and never penetrated. We get to walk in the grounds, she said, but we never enter the building. The purpose of festivals like this one had become less and less clear to her, despite the fact that she was on its board of directors, while the personal value of books had, for her at least, increased. Yet she had the sense that the attempt to make a public concern out of a private pastime, reading and writing, was spawning a literature of its own, in that many of the writers invited here excelled at public appearances while producing work she found frankly mediocre. In the case of such people, she said, there are only the grounds. The building isn't there, or if it is, it's a temporary structure that will be swept away by the next storm. But she recognised, she said, that her age might have something to do with this jaded perspective. Increasingly, she found herself turning away from the contemporary, back towards the landmarks of literary history. Lately, she had been rereading Maupassant and was finding it as fresh and as charming as on the day it had been written. Meanwhile, the unstoppable juggernaut of commercial literary success pressed on, though she had the sense that the marriage between the two principles, commerce and literature, was not in the best of health. A small adjustment in public tastes, she said, a thoughtless decision to spend one's money on something else, and the whole thing, the global enterprise of fiction publishing and its affiliated industries, could be gone in an instant, leaving the small rock of authentic literature where it always was.
Thank you. I love that passage. And I think it perfectly illustrates the disjunction between art itself and everything, this whole edifice around it that is, you know, capitalism and selling books and publishing and awards and all this other kind of thing that the author is compelled to take part in. One thing that I'm curious about with that passage is, you know, just for our listeners, like your last three books all have this quality of people speaking to the narrator who doesn't really reveal herself. She just hears and witnesses. She's like a recording device. And what's been said in, you know, The Nation and other places is that you have sort of inverted autofiction, which, you know, which is a term for the fiction that uses details of the author's life and the author's persona. You've inverted it because there isn't your life in it. It's sort of the life of those that you or your narrator encounters. But with a passage like that, I wonder, do the thoughts that the narrator, Faye, hears, do they come from, you know, in a sort of documentary, nonfiction-y, journalistic way? Do they come from interactions that you've had in the world? Are they your own feelings and thoughts put into the bodies of these other people? Do they come from your imagination? Like, what is the alchemy that creates these stories that the other people tell Faye?
I'm surprised to hear you asking me that question, Sheila. Because I'm sure you yourself know the answer.
Well, I know the answer for my books, but not for yours.
Yeah. I think what I was looking for in writing these books was a sound frequency, a note, where, because really it's sort of the idea of narrative and how it's the way that people see their lives. You know, the tiny child goes to school on day one and comes home and the parent says, "What was your day at school like?" And they tell the story. And if someone laughs at a particular point, they accentuate that the next time they tell it. So, I mean, I think even a small child does that. So I thought that actually some of the freedom that I was looking for, freedom from form, really, and from particularly the burdensomeness of the pretend ignorance of the author pretending that they don't know what is in their book, that actually using people's native ability in talk to write narrative, essentially, as I say, a frequency, and I hear it in people. So, I mean, to answer your question, you know, I'm very aware when these passages of life occur, when people are able to utter themselves, that it's something that I really notice, when someone becomes immersed in their own talk and they access an ability that is a narrative ability. So that particular moment I'm very attuned to, and you know, there's lots of things that people say that are of no use to me at all.
This kind of listening that you're engaging in, was that the way that you listened before you wrote in this style, or did writing this way create in you a desire to listen to the world and to take in the world in this way?
I would just really notice this, that you know, with some people that they would describe something and you absolutely can't see what it is they're trying to describe, and other people can. They can, you know, find the salient details. And, you know, I really wanted to write a literature that was free of dread and free of suspense, and that also didn't sprawl so much. So passing as much of this burdensome material through humans, so it was a sort of, I guess, I just turned inside out what I sort of already knew and what I'd been doing before. So that's sort of how I got there.
Yeah, and the people that speak, I mean, they have characteristics and they're storytellers, but they're not characters in the laborious, heavy sense of, you've seen this man before, now here he is again in literature. You've seen him 100 times in literature. These are people telling stories for themselves. And I'm curious to talk to you about character a little bit, because, you know, even though you're in some sense taking away so many of the writerly tools, you know, which are used to create character, these people are so specific and so precise and so well drawn. And I get the sense that part of this new way of writing character comes out of maybe a feeling that we aren't as distinct from each other as we once were, that this sort of Victorian idea of like human types and, you know, that people have such very different souls, that that's kind of outdated, and that, that we're all kind of the same as each other now. I mean, even the language that the characters tell their stories in has a kind of uniformity.
Mm. The sort of mark of the good novelist is his or her character changes over the course of the novel. You know, that John will be one thing and then will be shown to have changed, you know, by the end. And I don't see it that way. I don't really believe in character. I believe in moments of truth. And that a moment of truth is, even if it's just literally a momentary emergence, like someone getting out of the sea and standing on the rock for a minute and sort of looking around, for whatever reason they can see where they are, they can see themselves and they can see what's around them, and they can say what it is. And you know, the times that one can do that in one's life, you know, it's probably not that many. It's, well, it's certainly not all the time anyway. So I suppose I felt that there was the possibility of iconic utterance, if I can call it that, and something that if you live in a particular way, becomes more and more available to you as you get older, I guess.
What's that particular way?
The right way. The true way.
I mean, the other element that I would put in there in terms of, you know, the ingredients of a truthful moment seems to be a kind of recognition of a certain darkness or a certain life as an accumulation of losses, an accumulation of recognition of one's failure, sort of a realization that we actually aren't people who live by any kind of moral code as much as we might wish to. Do you think that one element of this truth that you've tried to capture on the page is this, I wouldn't even say a nihilism, but just kind of like a futility at what humans are able to manifest in their own lives or among the people they love or, you know, in relation to themselves?
I'm surprised to hear you say that. It's definitely not what I would have thought about my worldview. I think my writing is a positive view of life. That's how I feel.
What's the positive view of life? I mean, I do find it entertaining. I like when writers show the darkness. I find it such a relief. I find it such good company. You know, I would never feel comforted by the rosy view of life and humans and human relationships. Like, mm-hmm. there's no solace there. But I mean, I'm curious what this positive view of life you think.
Well, because I think that writing for me is a essentially that is positivity. It, as a created object, is positivity. And so I think there's a point at which the things that you're saying in your beautiful writing cancel out your beautiful writing. And I don't feel that I'm doing that. I feel that this question of truth and particularly of female truth is one that I've really, really, really lived in and travelled in and suffered from and stayed with. And, you know, what a woman feels when she has a 6-month-old baby and is having to tell everyone that she's really enjoying it compared to, you know, what she might feel 20 years later about the deceptions that she went in for or didn't go in for. You know, I think people accumulate some significant moral burdens in their lives, and the people that interest me, I guess, are the ones that when they have a moment of elevation and they get a bit of a view of themselves are able to see that and are interested in finding out what the truth is. And I think it's really people wanting to know the difference between what they truly think and what appears to be. I suppose I don't see it as negative. I see it as honest.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose I think I see that there is a darkness in how far away we are from truth, how all the forces in life sort of conspire to keep one away from it. As you said, there may be only a few moments in life where one actually can stand in it. So to me, that is dark, you know, to me, and just the fact that, you know, one makes an aesthetic object for the world, that does represent a certain amount of hope, but it's hope in an otherwise, you know, very bleak landscape where one has to lie and is being lied to, and nobody is telling the truth. And
well, and I guess that's why I feel that my books are sort of the opposite. You know, I am trying to capture people in these moments of truth-telling, or to, I suppose, describe the parts of life where that might become a possibility. So maybe I'm, in fact, more of an optimist than the average person.
Yeah, I kind of want to talk a little bit about middle age, because I feel like the crisis of aftermath, your book about divorce and sort of the crisis of these books is a specifically middle-aged crisis. You know, it comes after decades of world building, you know, for the person, you know, making family, making career, making meaning. And then there's this crisis of what interrupts it. Can you continue on with these ideas, you know, through the second half of your life? And I'd like you to read a quote from Outline, if you have it in front of you. Mm-hmm.
Okay. I felt that I could swim for miles out into the ocean. A desire for freedom, an impulse to move, tugged at me as though it were a thread fastened to my chest. It was an impulse I knew well, and I had learned that it was not the summons from a larger world I used to believe it to be. It was simply a desire to escape from what I had. The thread led nowhere, except into ever-expanding wastes of anonymity. I could swim out into the sea as far as I liked, if what I wanted was to drown. Yet this impulse, this desire to be free, was still compelling to me. I still, somehow, believed in it, despite having proved that everything about it was illusory.
Thank you. Yeah, I love this passage. And I think that this is something that represents like the wisdom of midlife, like the idea that there is some future freedom is an illusion, but yet one still feels the tug towards it. Can you talk a little bit about this?
Well, I mean, I think part of what the passage is saying is that knowledge is not helpful, that you can know something and still be unfree. You can know that you suffer in particular ways, or that you are weak in particular ways, or make choices that are not the right ones. You can know it and you can still do it. And, you know, that's the reckoning in middle age. It is, in fact, a tragic sense that you have been formed by things and they were not real. They were the products of your upbringing or conditioning of gender or of social class. And I think there's a certain point where it's like a stage set beginning to to sort of crumble, and you start to see it wobbling. And in the world that I'm describing, that's a realization that is arrived at only after the world has really sort of beaten you up a bit, and you know that such things as divorce happen and family breakdown
but it also seems kind of relaxing if all those things are falling. I mean, it seems terrifying, but also relaxing and relieving if all those rules, let's say, one's unconsciously following, you know, start to become you start to see them, they become conscious, and then they disappear. Like, well, if you're kind of left alone in this.
It's very probably a character trait of the person who might have these realizations that they've also been absolutely conditioned to believe that the worst thing to do is to waste time. So the thought that you've wasted, you know, your entire life at the service of things that didn't really exist, you know, as the sort of psycho terminology goes, you know, in a prison where the door in fact was open, and you've sat there all this time. So a lot of what I'm writing in these books is very much concerned with that.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of feel like the engines of ambition, whatever propels people, you know, who are ambitious, that's a thing of youth, perhaps because there's so much illusion involved in what the outcome of all that ambition can be, or, you know, whether there's actually somewhere you imagine you're going to. You know, there's something to be said for the opposite, which I think is what your books show, which is like, in fact, the absence of self, the witnessing rather than doing, you know.
And I mean, one of the crucial parts of the book that, you know, I'm not sure whether it's an element that people particularly notice, but the children of the narrator they appear in order to demonstrate that this narrator is making a concerted attempt to break the chain, as it's called, you know, that this freedom, when it comes, is nothing if it leaves people unfree behind you. And, you know, the books end very much with that very clear idea of her children also being free, not just her.
Yeah. One of the things you're talking about being free of is gender, I would say. How do you imagine that's going to inflect the kind of writing you do next, to if they are coming from like a more genderless place, where up till now so much of what you have been trying to struggle free of are these illusions, or are these deceptions, you know, that are connected to femaleness or femininity?
No, I mean, it is a huge question, and you know, I've been asked occasionally lately, when I do the thing that I should be freeing myself from and go and sit on the stage at the whatever festival, and you know, one is expected to have a view about, you know, the Me Too movement, for instance, or issues of sort of feminism and sexual politics today, and I find I have nothing to say. I felt I lived as a woman, you know, I lived through womanhood in the most sort of basic and indeed arduous ways, and now I don't feel gendered, and I'm interested in knowing what is after gender. I suppose I see it as a blankness of spirituality ahead of me, and I'm interested to know what's in it. So yeah, that's where I'm going.
Maybe you should leave the bloody island and come to the land of trees and expanse.
I know. I would have enjoyed being shortlisted for the Giller again.
Thanks so much, Rachel.
Thank you, Sheena. It's lovely to talk to you.
Yeah, lovely to talk to you. That was your Canada Land. You can find me online at www.sheilahetty.com. Our crowdfunding site is patreon.com/CanadaLand. This episode was produced by Ali Graham. Canada Land's managing editor is Kevin Sexton. And if you like what we do, please support us on Patreon.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.